This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many delegates at the UN Population Conference in Cairo have argued that improving women's rights is an essential step to controlling population growth. Dr. Jonathan Mann is an epidemiologist who's exploring the connection between human rights and health. He's the founding director of a new Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. Next week, the center hosts the first international conference on health and human rights. Dr. Mann was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program, and he chaired the 1992 International Conference on AIDS. He says that human rights is a precondition of health.
My own understanding of this came through AIDS. I had done a lot of work in AIDS over the last decade, and it became increasingly obvious to me that there was more to what we needed to do to deal with AIDS than just distributing condoms, providing information, providing counseling and support, and educational programs and so forth. There was something missing. And the key discovery for me was in Uganda. And a group of women lawyers in Uganda essentially explained to me that they understood that women in Uganda couldn't refuse unprotected or unwanted sexual intercourse by their husband, even if they knew their husband was infected with AIDS, because they didn't have the social status or the rights to be able to say no. In other words, very concretely, if they said no, they would either be beaten and they had no legal recourse, or they could be divorced entirely at the decision of the husband, and divorce in those societies would result essentially in civil and economic death. There'd be no property for the woman. She would be deprived of status. It's a form of death. So, in essence, the women lawyers group in Uganda decided in order to protect women against AIDS, their rights had to be protected. And so they've initiated the process of changing the laws governing property distribution after divorce as an anti-AIDS strategy. That really made concrete for me this linkage that allows a person to achieve a state of health or to protect their health when and if their rights are protected.
Do you think there are other epidemics besides AIDS? I remember the last time we spoke, you said that the AIDS virus has a way of gravitating toward the most marginalized portions of society.
Right.
Because the poorer somebody is, the more without information they are, the more without rights they are,
right,
the more likely they are to not know about the spread of AIDS or to not have the power to control their own decisions and making sure
absolutely
that they don't get it. So is this true of other epidemics too, do you think, of other viruses and other bacteria, that they gravitate to the marginalized portions of society?
It is. It's true if one looks at the history of diseases, both infectious diseases and chronic diseases. Initially, at the beginning of a major worldwide epidemic, say of a new virus or of a newly emerging virus, rather, it's possible for quite privileged sections of a society to be affected initially. Look at the situation, for example, in the United States or in certain African countries. In some African countries, the AIDS epidemic appears to have started among the highly mobile urban elite that was able to travel, in a sense, travel, get infected, and then come home with the virus. But give that society 10 years, give that virus 10 years in that society, and it will gravitate, just as you suggested and as we discussed earlier, towards the marginalized, the dispossessed, the poor, and those who are deprived by society of their rights and or their dignity. That's a general pattern, and it's as true of many cancers as it is true of heart disease, as it is true of injuries. Take the problem of, you know, injuries, and I mean by that what we used to call accidents, except the word accident implies that it kind of comes out of the blue and is unpredictable, whereas in fact, injuries are relatively predictable, and they do not occur homogeneously throughout a society. Certain groups in society are more at risk, more vulnerable to injuries than others, whether it's automobile injuries or injuries in the home or fires or drownings or whatever. And if you just look at the patterns, you see a clear distinction. And we claim that that distinction can best be described by doing a rights analysis. Those who are in most possession of their rights and dignity are least vulnerable. Those in least possession of their rights and dignity, deprived of their rights and dignity, are most vulnerable.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about how the current approach to public health internationally compares to what you would like to see it become.
Yeah, well, that's very much the focus of our work and what we're about. Public health has generally been pretty modest, at least in recent years, in its approaches and its claims. For example, with AIDS, if we look at AIDS prevention, the international strategy, the global strategy against AIDS, which I and colleagues developed when I was at the World Health Organization in Geneva, essentially involves an effort to provide people with information, with certain services, in the interest of helping them make decisions for themselves about their behavior, because behavior is, of course, at the root of HIV transmission, particularly sexual behavior. But we realized something much deeper once we got further into the problem of AIDS and its prevention. And we learned in part from our failures, from the fact that the AIDS epidemic is intensifying worldwide at the same time that the programs that we called for are multiplying and exist in many places. That paradox led us to ask what's missing. And this is what's missing in public health more broadly. What's missing is this broader understanding of the societal dimensions of health. We often think of health, we may, as individuals, think of health as something that involves our genetics, and then from there on pretty much involves things that we have control over. I use the example of the Ugandan woman married to a man with AIDS as just one illustration of the ways in which what look like choices are not real choices. And in fact, our, quote, choice has been determined by a societal context. That level of understanding of the way in which the way society creates conditions in which people can either be healthy or unhealthy helps us understand, Terry, why in the United States, the health of the black population, the health of the Latino or Hispanic population is not as good as the health of the white population. It helps us understand issues of women's discrimination against women worldwide and the relationship of that discrimination to health status. So public health of the future has to not only continue to use the normal tools of public health that have been developed traditionally, but has to address the roots of the problem itself, the roots of AIDS, the roots of problems in health like cancer and heart disease and injuries and violence. And those roots are societal, and we have to address them societally. We think that the human rights perspective will give a coherent strategy to this effort to influence society in directions so that people can be healthy.
So who do you have to convince? You have to convince epidemiologists, doctors, human rights workers, governments?
What we're trying to do most of all is build bridges between health workers and human rights workers, because we see a commonality of interest and a commonality of action. We want that to develop. For that to develop, they have these two groups, the health workers and the human rights workers, have to learn how to talk to each other. And that's one of the main reasons we've organized the conference next week, the first international conference on health and human rights, to create kind of a bridge between these two communities who speak really rather different languages at first glance.
What's the difference between those languages?
Well, you know, most public health, unfortunately, still takes place in the biomedical language. That is, the language of morbidity and mortality and physical causes of disease or disability or premature death. Most of the people working in health are physicians or have medical-type training. On the other side, most human rights workers either are lawyers or have legal training or come from grassroots organizations with an activist community organizing kind of environment. And these groups of people speak really different languages, and it takes time and some patience for us to hear each other. Once we do hear each other, we then can be at the point where we can begin to say things like this. If we're going to fight AIDS successfully in this country, we're going to have to deal more successfully with issues, for example, of racism and homophobia. Now, can health workers stop by just saying that, or do health workers have to, having recognized these as roots of the problem, do health workers now have to work with rights people to try to correct the conditions, ameliorate the conditions that in fact lead to the health problem in the first place?
My guest is epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. He directs the Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about health and human rights with Dr. Jonathan Mann. You've said that it was your work with AIDS that made you realize how important the connection between health and human rights is. Do you think that the international AIDS community is actually making that connection and how they're approaching the epidemic?
Actually, paradoxically, and I can speak from the experience recently of being at the Yokohama AIDS Conference last month, Paradoxically, at the higher levels, so to speak, that is, at the level of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, I don't think they're getting it. However, at the level of the grassroots organizations, at the level of the people and at the field level, not only do they get it, but they're the ones who are really advancing the field more than those of us that, you know, that sit in what are sometimes called ivory towers, although I don't think in this case that would apply. Still, the real creativity occurs when people face concrete problems concretely in the field. So there are groups working against discrimination, against homosexuals, against sex workers, against women, against adolescents. There are groups that are seeing that when you increase the educational status in a community, and when you increase opportunity for better jobs, you create a situation in which the vulnerability to AIDS will decrease. You know, it was said very early in the AIDS epidemic in this country that if you want a young African-American man in the inner city to wear a condom, you need to start by giving him a future. That kind of insight has been grasped at the grassroots level, but I'm afraid at the international level, at the official level, this is probably too threatening, frankly, to the status quo to be undertaken in any official way. Instead, what you see are the words human rights sort of plastered here and there on declarations, but without any content.
You're going to be bringing together human rights workers and doctors at your conference next week. Do you feel like somebody who's bringing together two different sides of the family who haven't met yet, you know, or introducing one set of friends to another set of friends and you're not sure how well they're going to get along?
Well, I'd say it's like introducing two sets of friends and being pretty sure they're going to hit it off just fine, but maybe still being a little bit nervous that that they might not understand, you know, they might rub each other the wrong way somehow. I really think that, you know, the time is ripe and the movement of understanding about the relationship between health and human rights that has grown so rapidly through the AIDS experience that brought a lot of us, to speak for myself, I mean, I knew nothing about human rights and was really completely ignorant about rights all through medical school and school of public health and my work until in AIDS I found some things, discovered with the help of other people some things that have changed my whole approach and attitude towards public health and towards what we need to do. So this isn't for everybody. I don't pretend that all physicians are going to jump on this bandwagon and say this is great. And I don't think all human rights workers are going to be excited about working with health people, partially because health people often have a sort of a bad rep. I mean, a sort of a reputation of being just very narrow, biomedical, and wanting to control. So there are real issues there, no question about it. But like any good family or like any good group of friends, with a couple of days, a couple of dinners, and the chance to talk to each other and listen, I'm confident of the outcome.
What are some of the discussions you're most looking forward to?
Well, the range is really extraordinary. I think, for example, on environmental health and the right to a healthy environment, this is really, I think, a really critical area for us. Another area has to do with indigenous peoples and their rights and health. A lot has been discovered recently, but we want to hear more about the ways in which race, class, and gender discrimination occur in healthcare itself, which I think is really an important issue.
Do you have a lot of people telling you you're naive?
That's not new. You know, when I started the work on AIDS at the World Health Organization, people said, you can't do that work at WHO. WHO is just a big bureaucracy. But we did a lot of things that surprised WHO. And by the way, when I left WHO in 1990, when I resigned, I was told in sort of, angry words by the director general that I should never forget that AIDS is a health problem, not a human rights problem. And I'm pleased to report to you that now the AIDS program at WHO has a human rights section and that WHO itself is creating a health and human rights program of its own. Dynamite.
Do health policies ever have a bad effect on human rights?
They can. I think that we've seen clear examples, again, in AIDS and other areas, where health people will kind of react in a knee-jerk way to a situation. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, okay, we have a situation here. We need to, take these people, test them. We don't care whether they agree or not. And if they're infected, we're going to do this or that to them. These are all potentially very violating of human rights kinds of approaches. And a part of the work of our center is really to try to help educate health workers about rights, because only when they understand rights do they understand how they can achieve the health goals at minimal cost to rights. At the Harvard School of Public Health for the last 4 years, every graduate gets two scrolls. One is the diploma that they earned, and the other is a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for them to frame, because we believe that the Declaration of Human Rights is as important to their work in public health as the Hippocratic Oath would be for a physician.
Well, Dr. Mann, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jonathan Mann directs the Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. Their International Conference on Health and Human Rights begins September 22nd at Harvard. This is Fresh Air.